Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, joined as always by Ann Thompson. I'm here in New York. Ann's out in Los Angeles, but not for long, because as we're recording this, you're about to go to the airport to get on a flight and join me in New York for the New York Film Festival. So very excited to have you here at this time.
Looking forward, Eric.
Back on your home turf. I know you're a New Yorker. I'm not going to pretend that this is an East Coast, West Coast turf war or anything like that. When you're here, you're back where you belong.
I'm back home.
I have to tell you, you are, and you've chosen a good time to come because
New York in the fall is a special crisp air New York Film Festival thing. It's like heralding fall. I looked forward to it every year.
Film prom at Tavern on the Green. But I have to tell you, I mean, I've been out and seeing this city wake up in a lot of different ways, and it's been really thrilling to be kind of back in the rhythms of the fall movie season. At home, we had that experience at Telluride of, oh yeah, it is possible to have that experience on the road. But here in New York, you know, I was out last night, we're recording this on Thursday, and I went to the Whitby Hotel and moderated a Q&A for Coda, then headed up to Tavern on the Green, which felt like sort of a prelude to opening night New York Film Festival. It was actually a party for Many Saints of Newark. Two totally different kinds of crowds, but I mean, New York thrives on this kind of event-based culture and you know, really gathering the creative community to launch films and you know, create sort of buzz around things in a way that is very unique to this kind of environment. So it's really exciting to have New York Film Festival come along right now, reopening Alice Tully Hall as it has this month, to kind of give this sense that it is possible to move forward in this city. Rather than just, you know, with these sort of isolated events, but just collectively, you can feel it across the board that the events are coming back. And
it's a live festival. You have to be vaccinated and you go into, it's going to be interesting to be back in some big cinemas. We launched the International Documentary Association series that we help promote at IndieWire. And we did The Rescue, which played really well. And it was outdoors in a parking lot on a big screen with headphones, which takes care of that issue of
bad
hearing
sound.
Helicopters and you know, sound. You don't hear other people in taking their breath or gasping or.
Well, anything. You need that for this movie because it's so claustrophobic. You wouldn't want to lose the kind of the textures of being trapped in a cave.
It worked really well. It played really well. That's going to be a strong documentary contender, which is an interesting question because I know I'm off topic, Eric. But that movie is by the filmmakers who made Free Solo, and they won the Oscar. So it's unusual to go back up a second time and get in again. If it got nominated, it would be a very strong contender.
Well, Chai Vatsarhelyi and Jimmy Chin obviously know how to play this game because they played it so recently. And if the film is strong enough, then why not? They've got the same team behind it. I mean, their editor who worked on Free Solo and so forth. So it seems like there's
Bob Eisenhart.
Yeah.
Really good editor.
So there's
He did all three of their movies. He did Maru as well.
You can talk about the craft of this movie as much as you can talk about, you know, the harrowing adventure story that's at the center of it. Certainly there will be a lot of other docs competing this year and it's going to be
more than enough.
But
anyway, we're also doing indoor, I did an interview with Jake Gyllenhaal for The Guilty, which is opening up a Netflix movie. And, you know, we did it in person. So it's really, I've talked to Ann Dowd, who stars in the movie Mass, which is up for possible supporting acting contention. Because they're all going supporting in that case. It's nice to see people in person, to sit down and actually talk to a human being, and you get the sense that other people also are excited by it. How was the Coda one you did?
Well, the Coda thing was fascinating because, first of all, remember that this was a movie that launched at Sundance. It won all these awards, like way too many awards. And in some sense, they just sort of like dominated the awards. But it got the biggest deal in Sundance history with Apple. And yet we all experienced it at home, and the filmmakers and the talent, nobody got that big premiere moment. This was an all guild screening. And for a lot of the cast who were there, it was their first time watching it with an audience.
That's lovely.
It was great. I mean, when I came out on stage, I was like, look, I watched this movie on a couch, but it definitely is better to see it with a crowd. Right. And everyone was sort of cheering because
that's why I saw The Rescue again.
Right. It makes a difference. Yeah. It makes a difference. But the other thing that was fascinating about Coda in particular, and for folks who have watched it, you know, I mean, most of the actors are deaf, is that doing a Q&A with that cast is a fascinating dynamic, because they actually had a Coda translator on stage who had actually worked on the set for the film, who the two main deaf actors, Troy, who plays the father, and Daniel, who plays the brother, were sitting on the stage looking at that person for translations. And they had two translators in the front row with microphones, so when each of the actors responded, you would hear their voices in real time. It was really fascinating, and it worked super well. So they were doing tons of Q&As. I actually think, in spite of whatever people have said about, well, maybe this movie didn't get the kind of lift you'd expect from a massive Sundance sensation, Apple is really investing in getting
this
movie
out there.
They're
going to
get it
seen.
And early. Yeah.
That's the thing. It's Oscars are all about, any kind of awards is about the people seeing the movie. And if they do enough work outreach and get it shown to enough people, it'll make a difference.
So
that's what it's about. So opening night of the New York Film Festival is Friday. And a lot of you are seeing press screenings early. I'm going to miss that
part. The
old
ritual is back.
Yeah. But I'll be there for the press screening in the morning. I'm going to see it twice. I do this every time.
Because you've got to be there. Twice in one day, because One is the opportunity to just see the movie in the context of being a journalist and processing it just on its own terms. And the other is, you know, date night and going out and having a good time.
And the tavern on the green. And I'll get to see all my IndieWire buddies and all my friends in New York. So the movie, of course, is The Tragedy of Macbeth. And the teaser broke this week. It looks very black and white, very Orson Welles kind
of
looking.
Very black and white. Yeah. As opposed to kind of black and white.
It leans into it. No, it's the fog. It's the fog that makes it look very Orson Welles. And then we have, so that's Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand. Of course, Denzel has done Shakespeare on film before. He worked with Kenneth Branagh on Much Ado About Nothing, which at the time was a big deal. He was breaking the color code, and it was an interesting choice on Branagh's part. And it became standard issue. It became no big deal after that. But at the time, it was a thing.
It's fascinating to look back on that, because it wasn't, at the time, it wasn't even that long ago. But it certainly took a long time to get to that point. And now it's, you know, nobody's really going to question it in any particular way, although it is, these are older actors to play these characters. So that might be something that people will scrutinize. I mean, we seem to look more at age now than race when it comes to who's the right person to play X part.
And how judgmental we can be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to bring up something else, though, because now we've touched on two topics that are also relevant to another film. One is black and white, and the other is Kenneth Branagh, who over the weekend emerged very well from the Toronto Film Festival.
As predicted.
Belfast won the People's Choice Award, which is often a bellwether for the Oscars. Not necessarily Best Picture, but it does mean that it is a real contender.
Last week, I suggested that King Richard should have won, might have been a contender. It wasn't in TIFF at all. So that's why.
But it might have won. That would be the other one.
That's an interesting choice that they made, not to book it. And I have no idea. I have no idea what the behind the scenes foot pattern was on that. Maybe they wanted Will Smith to show up. Maybe he didn't want to go. I mean, he got away with not going to Telluride because of various COVID protocols. But he I think that movie would have been a competitor for the audience prize. And there are movies like Birdman that didn't go to TIFF and ended up winning the Oscar anyway. It's not a thing. It's just that if you do win, it gives you an enormous, it puts wind in your sails.
But the question is, what
says you're a contender.
Right, you know? Because when Jojo Rabbit won, it was a contender and it won... The screenplay.
Adapted Oscar. Screenplay.
Right. So,
yes. But it was a Best Picture contender, too.
It was in the conversation. And certainly Belfast is there. I like the movie. I have a lot of respect for it. I do feel like there are, with something like King Richard and something like Power of the Dog, some louder movies that get much more complex reactions from the crowd in a way than this movie. So I wonder if, you know, on some level, the festival hype around Belfast, which is not going to New York Film Festival, is going to be something that continues to evolve as other movies kind of come into the conversation. I mean, how do you keep for Focus Features a movie like that elevated in the conversation when this
sometimes
is going to be pretty heated?
It's sometimes dangerous to be the front runner in that way. What it shows, what it demonstrates, is that it has populist appeal, that it plays. And as we talked about last week, it's just so gratifying to be in rooms where you can see how a movie plays. And you could see that Belfast played well. The question there is, how broad is its appeal? The actors are going to love it. So remember, that's the dominant branch. But we'll see. We'll see. The others...
And it has Jamie Dornan as a secret weapon who seems to be really good at charming the crowds. So.
But it's going to be... And Kenneth Branagh is a very compelling and he's it's fascinating because he's been nominated as a writer, a director, and an actor. And so this time it could be Best Picture. He's gotten recognition across the board.
I guess the thing that I'm sort of curious about, I come out of this having seen King Richard, Power of the Dog, and Belfast, and looking ahead to New York Film Festival, where, you know, Power of the Dog is the centerpiece, Almodovar Films closing night, and I'm wondering what else we need to see to know if we've already seen the Best Picture winner, because it does feel like if you look at the rest of the release calendar, it would take a lot for something to surprise at this point and upend the race.
If you look at Adam McKay's Don't Look Up, that does look very much like a comedy, an ensemble comedy with lots of little tiny parts. It doesn't look like Cate Blanchett as a newscaster is like a juicy supporting role necessarily. I mean, we'll find out when we see it.
I'm looking forward. It looks like a wild Gonzo movie.
I can't wait. But, you know, that would have to hit on the right cylinders to be, it looks like it's goofing on people and on our society in the way that Adam McKay often does. The other one that we don't know yet is West Side Story, which will come out very late in the day and could be that late running movie that sort of takes over everything if it turns out to be really good. Stephen Sondheim was promoting it on the Stephen Colbert show.
Yeah, that was very well handled. I mean, I'm sure somebody planted
that. That's a validation, right? If you like. And it reminds people, too. I mean, back in the day, West Side Story, 1961 version, had all sorts of warfare going on behind the scenes. It was by no means, it was a power struggle of who was going to dominate that movie. Was it Robert Wise? Was it Sondheim was kind of shoved aside? Was it Bernstein? You know, that movie, and also that movie's far from perfect. I'm willing to admit that it could be improved upon. The music and the dancing was great, but there were so many reasons to be a little unhappy with some of the other aspects of it.
I'm intrigued by what Sondheim said on Stephen Colbert, where he said that Tony Kushner found these innovative ways to position the music. I think the question I have there, and I'm somebody who's always felt like you can never discount Spielberg. I mean, with Ready Player One, which I thought deserved more appreciation.
Me too. But I agree with
you. I remember it was like nobody thought that movie was going to end up being as satisfying as it was. And then there it was at South by Southwest and everyone was like, whoa, this movie is amazing and challenging and doing new things. And with West Side Story, I guess the question is, even if Kushner has found some innovative ways to position the songs, it's West Side Story. You know what you're getting. Does a movie that is such a familiar property end up being the late breaking film that upends when we have, you know, a Jane Campion movie, a Kenneth Branagh movie, Will Smith's passion project about a high profile sports story. Like it's going to be a pretty busy conversation by the time we get into these December movies, and who knows what the Paul Thomas Anderson film is like.
Again, I mean, Licorice Pizza. We'll have to see.
I just laugh when I hear
usually,
that name.
I know. Usually that's his movies are respected and admired by the critics and not necessarily, you know, populist. You know, the craftspeople always appreciate what PTA does in the Academy. We'll see what kind of oddball movie it turns out to be. It's a question of where it falls on the range of oddball.
The other thing I thought was fascinating out of TIFF was going into it, we assumed, I think, the Best Actress race was about to be upended by Jessica Chastain with the Eyes of Tammy Faye. She was getting this special award. We talked a bit about this before that, you know, she really is the thing that carries this movie and transcends it in certain ways. But we've got this trailer up on the site for Spencer calling Kristen Stewart the front runner. And that's a pretty significant thing that she has basically survived that status after, you know, Chastain getting this higher profile.
Well, remember, we haven't, you know, and we've seen the movie. So we know how good Spencer actually is.
Yeah.
And so I think in the end, the critical hosannas that are surrounding Spencer give her a lift, whereas Eyes of Tammy Faye got mixed reviews. And while Jessica Chastain got great reviews, and I think she'll end up in the race because it's a bravura, extraordinary performance, that what Kristen Stewart does is to pull the audience into empathy with her in this extraordinary way. In this,
and
it, she carries it every minute.
Wrong. And a role that could go wrong very easily, the accent, the familiarity of the persona and so forth. I do think that it's notable that both Spencer and Eyes of Tammy Faye are not going to New York Film Festival. So there's going to be some noise around festival stuff for a bit that doesn't involve these movies. I don't know if that changes things because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of Best Actress contenders, but it's going to be a whole process in terms of getting these movies out there in front of people and keeping those conversations going. And I wonder how some of these other films might, challenge the situation.
So the movies that might pop out of New York, I mean, Power of the Dog will consolidate itself. We'll find out about Macbeth. We'll find out how, I mean, I have to see Parallel Mothers. I can't wait to see it. One of the things I got to do this week was go on a preview tour of the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures.
Yes,
here in
tell
Los
us
Angeles,
about that.
Which is opening.
How cool
on
was the museum?
September 30th. And I've been reporting on this for years and years. A lot of the people that were there with me were kind of like, how many years ago was that tour we took? Like 3 years ago, you know, with the hard hats when they were under construction. So it's been delayed and all that, and it's super expensive. I mean, one figure that's being floated around is like $700,000.
A couple movies.
It's a huge thing. So Renzo Piano was there, who did the big sphere, and that we sat in the David Geffen Theater where they're going to have lots of premieres. And there's a Pedro Almodovar exhibit that he himself designed. And it's beautiful. It's like this extraordinary royal blue setting, dark setting with these great big rectangular panels with all the videos from his movies. It's just one of the most stunning visual exhibits there. And there's another one for Miyazaki, which is quite cool. There's a thing where you line up, and I was amused at my journalist colleagues because they were lining up to see the Oscar experience where you go in and win the Oscar and everybody's cheering for you for 5 seconds
while
you accept an Oscar and they send you a video. So that's going to be very popular.
I was going to say, you had that one tourist gimmicky thing to keep the...
No, that was a smart move. They always had that in mind from the very beginning. I remember I was at some early planning meeting that we did very years ago to talk about what we should do with this museum. I enjoyed myself. If you enjoyed the Kubrick or the Del Toro or the Tim Burton exhibits that were done over the years that have traveled around, there's a lot of that kind of level of immersion here into the craft of filmmaking, and lots of delicious little tidbits. My favorite thing was the backdrop from North by Northwest of Mount Rushmore, which was a matte painting. And they have it up on the wall. It's like a curved matte painting that they used throughout the movie. Behind all these different shots, and you see all the photographs, and you listen to the production designer talk about it, how they did it and how they crawled around on the, you know, other things that they created to make it real. I love that stuff. I'm a wonk.
You know, what all this reminds me is that we've had the Museum of Moving Image in New York for 30 plus years. And while it's certainly not as well funded as this excursion or getting the same platform, it does a lot of the similar things in its permanent collection. I mean, in terms of, or the permanent exhibits do have a lot of things about the art of making movies that are very family friendly and so forth. And it's kind of fascinating to have something like that right now when we're all sort of wondering, like, what is the future of the movies?
Well, this was the question we keep asking, is who's going to come to this? You know, if you live in LA and you're a cinephile, you're definitely going to go. But and tourists will come. My question is, do they get repeat visits,
right?
And how do they keep so they have a permanent collection, they change that up, and then they have what they have is the red slippers. They have R2-D2 and C-3PO and you know, iconic spaceships from 2001 and you know, all these
museum
things, yeah, that you can feel affection for depending on where you're coming from. I mean, they're obviously leaning into having to correct history a bit whenever there's something that's
racist
depicting
I mean,
white guys chasing the wrong people. So there's a lot of leaning into that and explaining that and contextualizing that in a way that I was a little worried about how they would handle it, but it's actually very cool how they did it.
I saw one photo of, there's Barry Jenkins Moonlight
tweeted. He got a note from Warren Beatty, the guy who handed the Oscar to the wrong person, telling him his win was deserved.
But then it was sort of in the
handwritten
same
note.
Thing. It looked like there were a bunch of those, right? Because there was one for Bela Lugosi's Dracula winning something, makeup or something like that as well. It seemed like they've collected a lot of these from over the years.
Well,
so
they have a rich, rich treasure of archives that are just going to be, you know, cycled in, cycled out, you know, as you can see the big iconic things that are going to stay there, but they're going to, the little details that you know, I didn't have time to dig in deeply. I'm going to go back. I can't wait. And there's also a part of it that has like magic lanterns from the 1700s, you know, all the kind of artifacts of showing movies that go back centuries. Right.
Well, that to me seems like the most valuable. I mean, I'm curious to know if you saw, was there anything related to TV? Because on some level, it seems like what we're talking about here is a museum that's about the moving image, but is also trying to be sort of faithful to what we call a movie and not other forms of that. But the Magic Lantern was not, you know, a traditional movie. It was something else.
And well, but it led to movies. It led to, you know, what ended up becoming.
So what are movies leading
action
to? You know,
well,
I mean,
that's a question. And I are asking that question
all the time.
All the time. I mean,
What
are the Oscars going to be about if movies no longer exist?
Well, or if they don't, if they are just part of a larger cultural equation.
Streaming
which
culture.
Is already true.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to Lyon, to Thierry Frémaux's classic film festival there, the Lumiere Festival. The Lumiere Institute is kind of like this. It's a movie museum. And when you walk through it, it kind of covers different stages in film history. And they do have a VR headset towards the end. And it's not like they're showcasing VR projects, but they're sort of hinting at the future. What will, you know, if we start with the Lumiere brothers as sort of like what we call moving images in the most traditional sense, what will they become next? So there is this sense of, well, we have to acknowledge that this is an art form that's in constant evolution and not exclusively tied to the thing that we nostalgically have grown up appreciating about it. So I think that's a tension.
And one of the things these people talked about was that this was something that came up 90 years ago as something that should be done. And it's sort of an interesting question. You know, why did it take them so long, and have they done it too late?
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to come see it. I don't know when I'll be in Los Angeles exactly next, but I'll be curious to see how it also, how the museum also interacts with award season now that in-person events are back. I mean, to what extent can they actually host events?
But there's a whole other aspect of this, which is for whatever reason, out of, you know, safety protocol concerns or whatever, the Academy is returning to the portal. The portal that they that costs each distributor, you know, like
$12,500.
$12,500. I was going to say more than $10,000.
Already, when I was talking to
more than $10,000. So they have to. So they're doing that money making enterprise at the expense of the cost that it is to them to show the movies in their own screening room to the Academy members at the height of, you know, we're talking about everybody's going back. You know, wear a mask, get vaccinated. You know, you can come and see things in a theater if you take the right precautions. The Academy isn't putting that up for people. That's not going to happen. They're going to have to watch it on the portal or go to other screenings being set by other people, which is what you did with CODA.
I think it's going to be a different season, even though that platform is there. I mean, the thing that's fascinating to me is that it's almost like, you know, the way you need theatrical to raise. You need a theatrical release in many cases to raise the profile of a film, and that can have a trickle-down effect even for people who choose to watch it at home. In this case, I feel like some in-person events might also nudge Academy members to watch things on the portal, because if they can't make an event or whatever, they realize, oh, but I do have access.
No, it's all a big marketing apparatus. Absolutely right.
And the other thing is funny.
Eric,
oh no, are we going on too long? We're going to make
finish packing.
And I hear I wanted to spend another 5 minutes ranting about Dear Evan Hansen, but I guess we'll have.
We
to
could do that. That'll be fun to rant about. Yes, let's do that. So Dear Evan Hansen is an example of yet another musical coming from Broadway, along with In the Heights. That isn't going over that well. Now, some people like it a lot, and I will say that I respect the craft that was required to even get it to the level that it is. But they made a very singular miscalculation with Ben Platt in the role. Well, singing in close-up constantly, you know, in this extraordinarily emotional, intense way that by the time you get to the end of the movie, you want to go like this. You want to go, I can't look at this anymore.
Yeah, well, the part of the problem, I wrote something about this on the site this week, actually, it's that the use of the close-up in this play is really, it's Achilles heel, because I saw the play, I saw the musical, and you're experiencing the totality of the stage. There's lots of big screens and stuff that capture the social media stuff happening, but you always have the characters sort of in miniature, and that's an interesting visual contrast. There's lots of action on the stage, but when you get close to him, you lose something. Lin-Manuel Miranda talked about this when he was promoting In the Heights and saying how he was learning about how to shoot a movie musical for Tick, Tick, Boom. What happens when you get close to an actor's face? Like, they didn't really, I think, interrogate that decision the right way, and it really throws off. It makes it more, I don't know, just more intimate in a way that it shouldn't be, because you're not really capturing the complexity of the story in question.
But it also becomes repetitive in a way. If you just have this guy singing and singing and singing, the rest of the cast is actually very good. And by the way, the Caitlin skill Beaver. Required, you know, yes, she's wonderful. And so is Amanda Stenberg, who actually wrote a song.
She should have been the main
nominated.
Character. Yeah. She should be the main character.
I actually think they should have considered casting someone else Ben Platt did own it. He was incredible on Broadway. But in the very first shot of the movie, you can see that he's wearing makeup.
That was makeup. Very strange. And it's accentuating
his
tastiness.
It's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible. And everybody's commenting on him, how he's too old to play this teenager, and comparing him to what he did on Broadway. What if they had put someone else in that role?
Well, I'll throw something else out there. What if they had gone the Hamilton route, captured this performance, and then sold the freaking thing to Disney Plus or wherever?
Way better.
It wouldn't have the same kind of backlash. No. And you have him at the peak of all that stuff. So it does actually make a good case for these live capture.
I couldn't agree more. They just did, what was the name of the other one from Canada?
Come Far Away.
Yes, which I saw on Broadway, which I loved.
Yeah.
So the other thing, Amy Adams is good in this. Julianne Moore is good. I mean, all the people who are playing in the supporting roles are just extraordinary. extraordinarily good. And I just think that Ben Platt wears you out in the end.
Okay, so we worked in the Dear Evan Hansen pan. You didn't miss your flight. And next week in New York, we'll be live. This is an industry-only event.
From Lincoln Center.
If you are an accredited member of the industry, you can get in. If you sneak in, we won't tell anyone, but it's 3 p.m. on Wednesday. And you can certainly heckle us from the crowd or just ask some questions or tune in next week and you'll hear what comes out of it. But I really look forward to bantering with you in public. It's always fun when we get together in person. So
hey,
I'll see
Eric,
you soon.
Looking forward. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Safe travels.